When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork. Refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer. Or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in. All with the style you want and reliability you can count on. So you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
This episode sponsored by Ridwell. Doing the right thing shouldn't be so hard, but when it comes to recycling, it often is. Ridwell makes it simple to recycle more from anywhere. With Ridwell, you can recycle plastic bags, snack wrappers, pill bottles, bottle caps, and other items your curbside bin doesn't take. And unlike most recycling programs, Ridwell carefully tracks where your items go and reports back on what actually gets recycled. Getting started is easy. Order a starter kit, fill the bags with hard-to-recycle items, send them back for free, and Ridwell takes care of the rest. Start today at Ridwell.com.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek. I'm joined, as always, by my friend and comrade, Danny Bessner. And we are very pleased to welcome to the program Harrison Mann. He is a former U.S. Army major and executive officer of the Defense Intelligence Agency's Middle East Africa Regional Center, who resigned in protest of his office's support for Israel's war in Gaza under the Biden administration. He is currently with the group Win Without War, and he is a columnist for Zitteo. He has written a piece for Zitteo that seems quite relevant at the moment. I was a U.S. intelligence analyst. Here's what a ground invasion of Iran could look like. So we're going to talk a bit about that. But Harrison, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Wish it was under different circumstances, but we'll take what we can get. So before we get into the specifics of your piece, as a former Army intelligence analyst, just analyze the first 2.5 weeks of this war for me. Just give me the general overview as you see it.
Yeah, it's exactly what it looks like. Right? Since the first 12 hours of the U.S.-Israeli attack failed to turn Iran into Venezuela and generate an overnight regime change or client state, it really is surprising how little the Trump administration or even the Pentagon itself has had any plan for what comes next. And we've seen over the last week or so, I think, increasing frustration from the White House that they can't figure out a way to get Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which shockingly does seem to be a consequence that at least some folks in the White House did not predict. And so we've seen a lot of different grasping at straws. I think most recently Trump called upon NATO or China to come in and help him reopen the strait. And we have to note that right now the U.S. Navy considers it too dangerous to go in there. So the lack of the end game is apparent, but I always, when we talk about this, want to point out that what's happening right now, right, the out-of-control regional escalation and the disruption to oil markets, closure of maritime choke points, it's not a surprise to everybody in the White House, right? And I don't think it's a surprise to Marco Rubio or Lindsey Graham or Netanyahu, right? And this stuff was probably hidden from Trump or underplayed. But I always want to remind folks that what we're seeing now is exactly what you'd want to happen if you really want a war of destruction that just wipes Iran off the map as a regional player. And that's, at very least, you know, what the Israeli government wants.
Do you think it's at all interesting, and to the point about whether this is being hidden from Trump, we're starting to get leaks, most recently about the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, basically I don't think from him directly, but probably seems like from somebody in his orbit, saying things like, well, you know, we told the president that this was going to happen. You know, General Kane told the president that this Iran was going to close the Strait of Hormuz. And he said, it's not a big deal. They'll surrender before they do that. So it feels like already on, I mean, this is day, I guess, 17 at this point. Yeah. We got the finger pointing. And like, don't blame me for this. I said we shouldn't do this. You know, there have been leaks about J.D. Vance that have changed from the beginning, where he was like, gung ho, let's go in and blow the crap out of these people, too. Yeah. You know, I was really against this, actually, all along. Do you find it interesting that this early on, you we're seeing that stuff kind of get out to the press?
Yeah, I think that's good news for people who hope that the Trump administration will try and end this war as quickly as possible, that we're still in the first 2 weeks, and they're already looking for somewhere to pin the blame. The idea of Dan Kane, Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff, or his people trying to protect his reputation is a little funny to me, given the stuff that he has already greenlit. In my work, we've focused a lot on the most obvious war crime of the Trump administration, which is the boat strikes in the Caribbean and Western Pacific. And I guess he's more embarrassed about the idea that he encouraged Trump to do this war. I have trouble believing, well, let me say this. If somebody told Donald Trump, hey, this is going to quadruple the price of a barrel of oil or double or whatever, I'm
going
skeptical.
Going into the midterm elections.
Going into the midterm elections, drive up the price of literally everything, including agricultural products because of the fertilizer. I would be surprised if somebody made that case to him. And if they did, I'm sure Rubio or Graham was like, no, don't worry about that. But hey, this might not be fast, or we might lose some troops, is different than communicating the entire scale of the consequences.
To the question of how prepared they were for a conflict that went longer than, let's say, overnight, like Venezuela. The decision first to repurpose THAAD defense systems from South Korea to the region in the middle, 2 weeks into the conflict, a Marine Expeditionary Unit, an amphibious assault fleet from Japan, again, 2 weeks into the conflict. You didn't already have this stuff in place. They didn't have contingencies for evacuating people from the Middle East. Yep. Like the State Department had to do that on the fly. What else have you seen? Like, these things scream to me that they just didn't think this was going to go more than a couple of days. Would you agree with that? And what else have you seen that sort of indicates that they're kind of backfilling at this
point? I agree with that. And something interesting, right? A lot of these, especially like the force posture and moving new units in, like that those aren't decisions that Pete Hegseth makes, right? Those are decisions that are made or at least recommended by career military officers and Pentagon planners. So it's interesting to see a lot of stuff that you can't just chalk up to like, oh, the Trump administration cabinet members are not competent. And the one that I want to add on to that, right, is the way that those first six or seven U.S. troops died at the start of this war, right? Which is they were killed by a drone while sitting in basically a shack or like a trailer. And that one's quite shocking to me. Providing overhead cover should be a pretty easy thing to do, especially if you have it at least weeks, probably months, to prepare for this war. And that's an example of something, right, that the SecDef doesn't need to be involved in that. That's the CENTCOM commander. That's way down the chain, I would think, people who are not Trump appointees. But it's also possible that folks were dissuaded from doing that because they didn't want to look like, yeah, maybe you were not allowed to start staging troops or assets for a long war because of the impression that gave.
Just a quick question. Do you have any contacts in the administration or within the military? Because this seems to me that it would be very delegitimizing for professionals, in particular part of the professional intelligence apparatus or the professional military. Obviously, you can't reveal anything, but people talk. There's been a lot of discussion, particularly about fears of Trump postponing the midterm elections and things like that, which would, to my mind, rely heavily on military support for something like that to happen. So I ask in that context, but what has your sense been of the professional military and intelligence community's sense of this war and how it relates to what they view of their commander in chief?
Yeah. So I will say no specific like high up administration contacts. I'm still in touch, of course, with folks who are still in uniform and still in the community. I think, you know, the Intel community, the rank and file are probably doing close to what they've always done. And you saw, I think, a Wall Street Journal article that said the Intel community assessed that regime change was not a likely result of intervention in Iran, right? Those folks are still writing those reports. What may not be happening, and this is something I saw working in the IC under Biden, is those aren't necessarily getting briefed to the president, or they're not necessarily getting briefed to the president without being softened or adjusted for the PDB. And that's the same thing that happened when analysts were trying to say a little more explicitly what Israel was doing in Gaza. I would say some of the military officers who I've spoken to recently get it and are worried about the entire, the entire democracy thing, and specifically the very open threat from the administration to use the military, whether active or guards, in some way that undermines democracy. And something that me and my organization said a lot, like back last summer when we first saw the guard deployment in LA, is like there's a lot of things that are totally legal that you can order the military to do, right? I'm in Northwest DC. There's National Guard walking around here all the time. That you can get them into position where to either create the possibility of violence or just have them intimidate people through their presence.
I have to ask this. I mean, you brought him up, I don't want to get off on a complete tangent here, but Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, as ex-military, when you watch this man get up in his daily press conferences and brag about the death and destruction that the U.S. is raining down on Iran, or, you know, go back to all the press conferences about the boat strikes, as you said, you were talking about the boat attacks earlier, the most obvious war crime that these people have committed so far. When you watch him perform this, like, frat bro, we're going to, you know, kill everybody and sort it out later kind of routine. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah. Let me first say, like, on one hand, especially if you're in a more like line unit in the military, a lot of folks in normal times, politics doesn't quite break through, right? I was in the first Trump administration in the Army. I was kind of horrified by Trump, but it doesn't quite touch on your day to day. I think that's changing though, right? And you have much more deliberate politicization, right? It's let's remember, one of the very first things that Hegseth did as SecDef was fly every flag officer to Virginia to give a speech, which was funny to me because I was like, you couldn't calculate something better to piss off every military leader to you, right? Folks who wanted to not be checked in and not get caught up in Trump politics were forced to. So, yeah, I can imagine it's quite demoralizing for those who are paying attention. And, right, like, there's obviously going to be folks who are into the idea of being in the military and being able to kill whatever you want, no ROE. I can't say I didn't serve with people like that. And there's also a large number that values their self-image as a professional, right? You're not a thug. You have rules and legal limits and a specific process for waging war. And so, again, boat strikes. We've already seen probably hundreds of uniformed troops fail this test already by agreeing to do that, right? We've seen others like National Guard deployments where it looked more like maybe there were commanders trying to thread between what the intent of the order was and what the actual letter was to avoid doing something wrong. But it's, I think we have bigger issues right now than civ-mil relations, but this is bad for them.
I mean, when he says no quarter, which is an admission of a war crime. I mean, it's like, we're going to commit war crimes here against Iranian soldiers. Does it convey, do you think, it conveys what a target this paints, if nothing else? Even if you agree, like, we should kill Iranian soldiers on site, you know, no quarter, whatever, the potential for that to blow back on American soldiers in the region, do you think that conveys?
Yeah, or I think it could at least be, right, the Iranian government, like the foreign minister, have been very good at playing off of things that come out of the Trump administration. And so, as I think we'll discuss today, not difficult to imagine a scenario where U.S. troops are captured by Iranian forces. It happened before in like 2017 by accident, y'all might recall, in the same theater where some sailors basically didn't do their land nav training and the officer sailed them into an Iranian island. And so it's going to certainly increase the risk to those troops. And it also, right, we can imagine the situation where deliberately or not, Iranians kill U.S. prisoners. And you see Araghchi go on the news and say, well, Hegseth said no quarter, don't blame us. Unlikely, but it increases the odds of that. We can also talk, I'm sure you all have discussed the strike on the school already, but just the way it tags in there, right, is like an atmosphere of permissiveness, the same way that Stephen Miller and the president were messaging ICE, do what you want, break the law. This is, you know, aside from the bureaucratic ways that Hegseth has made civilian casualties more likely, like eliminating the civilian harm reduction group, it just culturally is going to create a more permissive environment where the things that maybe a pilot or a planner didn't do before because he knew it would be a career ender, they might feel a little more comfortable doing that now.
So let's move into your piece. You talked about the possibility here that you're going to have U.S. soldiers being captured by the Iranians, and that leads inevitably to this to your piece on the scenarios of a potential ground invasion. And I want to go through them individually, but just in overall, you know, this is something we talked about at the start of the war. There could come a point where there is nothing else for Trump to do but order some kind of ground operation inside Iran. There's no escalation that he can make he will have exhausted all the other avenues of escalation. I didn't think we were going to be 2 weeks into the war and already at that point. Do you feel like this is now inevitable, that there's going to be an incursion of some kind, or how close are we to the point where that's an inevitability?
Yeah, I don't want to say inevitable, but I think you're right. It's incredibly likely. Like, they've tried nothing and they're all out of ideas. They don't have a lot of other ways to go with this. And suing for peace is not really even on the table because I don't think the Iranians are going to let them yet. And so, like, one, out of ideas. Two, this is what Trump did in Venezuela, and it worked great for him in his mind. So, like, I don't think it'll be hard to sell him on this. And then three, for the camp that wants this to spiral out of control and wants this to turn into Iraq, right? Again, invasion of Iraq, maybe failure for the three of us, success for Israel. You've got a country that can't have ballistic missiles anymore. Then this is good, right? This is boots on, as I write in the piece, boots on the ground create a situation where Trump can't get tired and go home, which for a while with the air campaign, he could do. It's harder now with the Strait of Hormuz, but this really forces him to stay engaged even longer. So I think it's already being pitched to him, and we can talk about that, right? Like, just in the past 2 weeks, first, we've seen some folks outside the administration, Michael Rubin, from the American Enterprise Institute, who I think I'm going to credit with being the brainchild or credit him for resurrecting one of these ideas, which is taking Khorg Island or Kharg Island, going all around media as much as he could saying, hey, we got to seize this island. And a few days later, we have Trump administration officials leaking or just telling Axios, hey, we're looking at a ground operation to seize nuclear material. And now it's like we have the deployment of the Marines. And I think just in week two of the war, the headline, there's headlines about this kind of rampant, and they're no longer expressing shock. I think it's increasingly likely. I don't want to say inevitable because I don't want it to happen. And that takes us to a place where this war lasts a really long time and even more people die, including a lot of U.S. troops.
So I want to ask about sort of how long it would take to put together an operation, but maybe we can talk about that. We can go through these scenarios in order from, you know, it's sort of the smallest, most pinpoint possibility to the biggest, and maybe we can save the time frame conversation for when we get to the biggest of the operations. But you go through them in your piece, and the smallest is something that Marco Rubio was talking about, I think, even at the beginning of the war, like somebody's going to have to go in and get the nuclear material, the highly enriched uranium, and get it out so we can confirm. If you're going to make this war about Iran's, you know, supposed nuclear capabilities or the, you know, nuclear program, somebody's going to have to secure that material or else, you know, you won't be able to claim victory on that front. So this one, as you write in your piece, it's sort of on either end of it, it's tailor-made for something that U.S. Special Forces could do. You get in quick, you get out quick. But in the middle, you've got to dig a big hole in the ground in Isfahan and find the material that's buried under there, and you're sitting there. So talk about what that would have to entail.
Yeah, and you said it yourself. You're not actually getting out quick. So I think we could say, all right, it's feasible that a small number of special operations troops could insert into Iran undetected, maybe, or there's enough air cover that you can actually get them on the ground. During and after the June War, where the U.S. bombed Iran's nuclear facilities, the Iranian government buried the tunnels that you need to enter them, buried them in sand. So digging out that sand, if nobody bothers you, could take 1+ days. And that's like Delta Force is jumping in and they're parachuting their own excavator in, which is possible. That's setting aside the nearly unimaginable complexity of sending troops into the subterranean facility, finding everything they need to find, having the radiological protection to either be carrying out these canisters of highly enriched uranium, which are about 50-pound, apparently scuba tank size, so a guy could carry them. He might get life-altering complications from that. Or there's ways to like neutralize or sabotage them and leave them in place. So that's everything going right. We're talking maybe days, certainly over a day. Tons of specialized equipment needed. Additional assets probably need to come in if you want to actually physically remove the uranium. And you're supposed to do all this like 5 miles outside of the second or third largest city in the country. So who's going to protect those 50 to 100 special operators? I don't think 24/7 air coverage is going to be enough. You're going to need a cordon around them. And so it's not just 100 guys, right? That's that ready brigade from the 82nd Airborne. Maybe those Marines who are being sailed up from the Pacific. And that's just not an insertion, right? That's just a full invasion. And you can imagine, and this goes for every single option we're going to discuss, maybe some of these places you get in by surprise, you're not leaving by surprise, right? You now basically can have the attention of the entire Iranian military on you. And as something else I want to mention, like when you're on Iranian soil, we've gotten to see some of the capabilities of Iran's ranged weaponry, right? They are sending drones and missiles across the Persian Gulf that are going up against the most advanced air defense systems in the world and still, depending on the country, getting some hits in, you know, maybe 10 to 25%, depending on where they're hitting. Now imagine them shooting those same systems within their own country where there's no air defense to protect these guys, right? You could shoot a missile into the exterior of the Isfahan nuclear site. You could send drones after these people. They're incredibly vulnerable. You could use conventional artillery and rockets and short-range drones that Iran has not had the opportunity to use yet in this conflict because U.S. troops have not been close enough. So, like, it's impossible to overestimate the vulnerability of troops going to a nuclear site or really anywhere on Iranian territory. And I think it's not realistic to think that even overwhelming air power is going to prevent that, right? Maybe it prevents you from your perimeter getting penetrated once or twice. May not save you from a missile that's shot from somewhere in eastern Iran.
Well, I mean, this is the whole problem, is that they have to wrangle some sort of fake victory from something that doesn't have a plan.
Absolutely.
And this is like just the classic thing in military history, particularly post-World War II American military history, in that there's basically no strategic victory possible. So the military goes in and suffers. I mean, this is the whole Weinberger-Powell doctrine, right? Which is basically like, don't have no plan. And so they you could boil down those 6 points to essentially, you know, you need the public to support you. You need us to blah, blah, blah. It's basically you have a plan. And so this is why I'm really interested in that question of delegitimation, because this is like doing everything that doctrine for decades from basically 1975 onward was designed to avoid, which is that you don't do these things that have a very unclear strategic goal that are very difficult to achieve, that lack public support, that would generally need tens of thousands of troops to actually achieve. So I just wanted to, I mean, I'm a little bit of a military expert, but just really in the context of the politics and this is all just a function of there being no political goal here, essentially. And so they're trying to make one up.
And we could note on that, right? The Pentagon has tried to come up with military objectives that are actually like pretty defined and we could say achievable, which we've heard Kane and Hegseth say a few times, which is destroy their Navy, destroy their missile and drone capability. And maybe there's a third one there on destroying some other military thing. I think, you know, I thought it was notable when they started saying that in the first week of the war, because those are things that you could theoretically say, hey, we did it, right? They keep talking about we destroyed the Navy. It's like, yeah, they probably did. Those are ships. Those are easy to destroy. So I think that quote unquote win is still sitting there for them if they ever want to try and use it.
Israel. And I think this is the point, right?
No.
Israel actually has a different doctrine because the United States and its role of global hegemony and the fact that it doesn't face security threats is just a very different geostrategic position than Israel. Israel wants the chaos, like you said, in Syria and Iraq, because it basically wants to achieve a form of regional hegemony, but it is a very small state. So the only way you could do that on any sort of semi-lasting basis is basically a strategy of chaos. It's kind of, I mean, I don't agree with it, but it is not stupid. It is a smart and intelligent geostrategy. And so you have these divergent purposes here coming, because that would be a geostrategic victory for for Israel to get the U.S. involved. And so Iran can't essentially shoot missiles any longer. So you're going to keep on coming up against this thing again and again and again and again and again as this war goes on.
And I just one last thought on the nukes, right? I've talked about all the ways that it wouldn't work. Even if it somehow did work, right? We have no idea if the uranium is still where it is, right? I think the IAEA or satellite imagery saw a bunch of trucks coming up to the entrance after the June war. So it could really be anywhere. I just have to add, like all of the different ground options proposed, in addition to the tactical disaster, like the purported strategic objective wouldn't even get accomplished. So that's important to remember too, is that we just don't know where the uranium is.
This episode sponsored by Marathon Sports. Running shoes online can feel like a guessing game. But Marathon Sports makes it easy to get the right gear without stepping into a store. At MarathonSports.com, you'll find the same trusted brands runners and walkers rely on, including Brooks, Hoka, New Balance, Asics, Saucony, and more. Whether you're training for a race, walking for fitness, or just need everyday comfort, Marathon Sports has the shoes, apparel, and accessories to keep you moving. Their online shop is built for athletes and everyday movers. Easy browsing, detailed product guidance, and fast shipping help you find exactly what you need without the hassle. Because the right gear doesn't just improve your run, it improves how you feel every day. Shop now at MarathonSports.com and get moving.
This Mother's Day, give her something she'll truly use and absolutely love. Minky Couture blankets are the perfect mix of beauty, comfort, and luxury. From elegant neutrals to spring florals, there's a style just for her. Say thank you with softness that lasts far beyond the day. She deserves it. MinkyCouture.com, the original best blanket ever.
So let's talk about scenario two, which is dropping soldiers on Karg Island. And I have to question whether anybody who is pushing this idea has actually seen where Karg Island is on a map, where it's located. Because this is putting people in to be sitting ducks, basically, it seems to me. So the U.S. has already bombed supposedly military targets on Karg Island. Didn't touch, according to Trump, didn't touch the oil infrastructure because the precious pipelines, we can't damage those. The idea being that you put troops in and you seize Karg Island, where Iran exports 90% of its oil, and then, like, you know, question mark, question mark, question mark, the Iranian system collapses because there's no money and they can't pay anybody. This strikes me as flawed in so very many ways. But just talk about the first part of this, which is you're going to have to airlift people. They're not going to have armor. They're not going to have air defenses. They're just going to be boots on the ground, literally, in a place where they are rife for attack from three directions from Iranian forces. On the mainland. So just talk about the logistics of that.
I will. And I just have to mention one thing first. When we think, wow, what a ridiculous idea. On Saturday, Senator Lindsey Graham did a tweet urging Trump to use the Marines to seize Karg Island. So can't call this one off the table. And this is, I think, the most public appeal from an influential person we've seen to do that. So yeah, let's first
Lindsey
talk
Graham
about-
is such a wild character. I just want to, like, what a character, you know, a Pynchon-esque in his everything. But sorry, it's just like he is just really, you know, one of the classic characters of 21st century American history.
So yeah, so that, like, let's call this on the table. But yeah, Derek, as you mentioned, so Karg Island, it's about 5 miles long, so not that big. It is about 500 miles past the Strait of Hormuz. So by ship or boat, you have to make it through the Strait of Hormuz and basically go all the way almost until you reach land. And it's only 15 miles off of Iran's coast. And again, it is, you could fire at it from, like, at least three directions because of the curvature of the coast. So just want to start there to paint the picture. On the tactical side, it's everything I just described, where you're going to have U.S. troops trapped in now a really confined space, somewhere that you could already have, not just drones and missiles, but conventional artilleries and rockets. You could have those targets already dialed in, basically, of where they're going to be. Trump, on Friday, said he destroyed all military targets on the island. If that's true, it might mean he also destroyed anything that U.S. troops could use for cover from Iranian attack. If it's not true, it means there's still an untold number of Iranian troops there. I think that's more likely given the prevalence of underground facilities. I don't know if I even want to talk about why an amphibious assault would be like a suicide mission, but you got to get through the Strait of Hormuz and
right,
the mines and anti-ship missiles. But, like,
right off the table.
So, you know, when I wrote about this, I talked about the 82nd Airborne dropping troops in being an option. But with the Marine Expeditionary Unit, they also have a substantial rotary wing helicopter capability, helicopters and Ospreys that can move about like 400-ish troops at a time in one lift. So you could theoretically do that with these Marines who are underway. Let's start with the rotary wing, because that's like in terms of what's the least to most survivable way to insert amphibious, then helicopters, then airborne out of airplanes. So again, amphibious, I don't even try it. They could mine everything, sea, boat, drones, aerial drones, everything. Let's talk about helicopters, which could be tempting, right? Because we're moving that asset into theater and it'll be there in 2 weeks or so. One, let's understand that for just the 1,200 ground troops that are part of this MEU, and we got to remember, like, there's a lot of headlines saying 5,000 Marines and sailors going to the region. That's true. The number of those, that's the actual battalion landing team, like the ground element, that's only 1,200 Marines and sailors. So it's not that big. Taking them to Karg Island would take three lifts, which means certainly by the time the second and third trips are underway, Iranian forces have a pretty good idea about where they're going to land. Again, a landing helicopter or Osprey is easy pickings for pretty much everything Iran has, drones, missiles, and again, conventional artillery and rockets. If you drop them from planes, you avoid some of those issues. You maybe still have a residual air defense threat. Then you have the issue, as somebody with a very undistinguished nine jump airborne career, you don't land where you're supposed to, and the wind has a vote, right?
And I've seen Band of Brothers. I get it.
Yeah, I mean, that's real. That's still real today. And in this case, troops who don't land where they're supposed to are going to drown, right? Add to that, with a combat jump, you have like minimum 5 to 10 expectant casualty rate just from hitting the ground, right, with all that gear. But let's say you get troops on the island. Again, they are trapped. It's even easier to repel an evacuation force, whether by airlift or boat, than it was to repel the invasion force, because you kind of really know where they're going and when they're coming. And I would say that having the opportunity to create a mass casualty event of American troops, or to basically hold them de facto hostage on this island, is much more valuable to the Iranian government than holding on to this oil terminal, right? And like, we can get into the strategics, why strategically this makes no sense. There's no way Tehran didn't already price in getting all of their oil infrastructure bombed when this war started, right? I don't think once the US and Israel started attacking, they really expected they were getting away with any valuable strategic targets when this is over. So the idea that you could hold that hostage, and then, you know, Larjani et al. would basically say, we will surrender our sovereignty so that we can get this oil terminal back, which will then be controlled by a puppet regime, which is either us or somebody else, just doesn't make any sense. And like, once U.S. troops, I think we could say U.S. troops could maybe conceivably seize the facilities. Once that happens, they're much more valuable as a target for Iranian strikes than anything else.
The strategic aspect of this, that you could take Karg Island and the Iranians would just collapse, yeah, in a pile of goo, strikes me as the Trump administration assuming that Iran is also run by Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth. Like, that's the kind, yes, of thing that they would do. You know, yep, they would then devolve to like, wait a minute, you weren't supposed to do that. That's cheating. Like they've done with the Strait of Hormuz. Like, you weren't supposed to close the Strait of Hormuz. You're cheating. What's wrong? You know, what's the deal? Like, that's the attitude here. And it's inconceivable that the Iranians have not thought this through. Like, this is a vulnerable island in the middle of the Persian Gulf that they haven't thought through the scenario.
It's very similar to Russia avoiding the consequence of sanctions. That's what this reminds me of, is that the United States has been basically projecting its plans for decades, and it turns out that other states have been preparing for it. It's very similar to that. Like everyone thought that Russia was going to collapse because it would be closed off from the Western economic system, but actually they had been planning for this for a decade, and Iran has clearly been planning for this for a long time, and especially since last summer. So it's just like, of course. It really, lack of thinking about the American elite here, a century of degradation and decay.
I think, Derek, it's such a good point about like the lack of strategic empathy, or like almost the opposite, yes, of it. And it's like, the worst thing that Donald Trump can imagine is the stock market going down. So it must be the same.
The Iranians must have the same attitude.
As we are literally trying to kill them and their families, yeah, and the idea that they would be like, well, we gotta save the oil. They're trying to kill my whole family, but like, we'll trade away the oil as well.
Right. Or just the idea that if the Iranians were to run out of money, let's say they don't have a contingency for losing Karg Island, and they couldn't pay their forces, yeah, that these people whose country is under attack,
yes,
would say, okay, well, if you can't pay me, I'm not going to fight for you anymore. Like, that may be what Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump assume the U.S. military would do in that situation, or what they themselves would do in that situation. But I don't think you can make that same comparison to the Iranians under invasion, under the threat of invasion or being attacked. Like this.
Yeah. I mean, the Trump administration is making TSA agents work for free right now.
Right.
So you would hope they could imagine that people defending their country would work for free. And the other thing I want to add on that side of like the economic collapse is because they've been under U.S. sanctions so long, Iran has a nearly totally self-sufficient defense industry, right? So it doesn't need a strong economy to keep producing munitions and drones. And where does it get the stuff it can't make on its own from? Russia and China, who I'm pretty sure are going to be very willing to still hand over like those specialized parts and components, yeah, on credit, especially China, which is, you know, hoping to maintain access to discounted oil.
So your third Mm-hmm. And most absurd scenario is putting a force in to seize the coastline of the Strait of Hormuz. And this is messed up on so many levels. But let's talk about the logistics first. How quickly... You talk about how quickly the U.S. military could put together a 10,000-ish strong rapid invasion force. How fast could that happen? And would that be enough? Or would you have to then follow that up with a much larger force to try and hold this strip of territory?
Yeah. So like the 1,200 ground troops that are sailing over on the Mew are meant to be in region in about 2 weeks. I think that would conceivably be enough time to have, on top of that, another 10,000. You have 4,500 in the 82nd Airborne's Ready Brigade. They're ready to go in 96 hours is the standard. And you could probably get another airborne brigade either out of the 82nd or 11th Airborne Division in Alaska ready with like two weeks notice, plus Ranger Regiment could be potentially another couple thousand. So I think if Donald Trump really was just like, what's the most we can throw at this now, you do make that 10,000-ish number plus maybe 1,000 or 2,000 who are already in Kuwait on a normal rotation. Is that enough? It's enough to do something. Like, it's enough to start a really big war. And I think the hopeful estimate, like the optimistic assessment you could make, is that it would be enough to seize a foothold somewhere long enough for like an Iraq-sized invasion force. But that's being so optimistic by somebody who has not done the math on this. I mean, let's talk about the map again and what securing the Strait of Hormuz means, right? If we want to talk about where you could get line of sight fire from missiles on ships going through the Strait of Hormuz, right? It's not just the area directly across it in that 30-mile wide gap. It's like 100 miles on either side, right? Because anti-ship missile range of 300 kilometers, you don't need to be right next to the ships. So that's like 200 miles at least of coastline that theoretically you would need to occupy or at least like keep clear of anti-ship missiles. I don't think you could do that with 100,000 troops, but you could maybe land them and do part of it while they're under constant assault from basically the entire Iranian army. Everything we've discussed about U.S. troops on Iranian soil being sitting ducks like applies there, right? On top of that, there's the issue of sustaining that force, which I really don't know how you do, to be honest. It would be hard to do it at scale by aircraft, and so I don't know. You're sailing more ships through the Strait of Hormuz getting mined. Like the ways that this could be a disaster are kind of tough to fully work through. But I will say that if you really didn't care about casualties and you really just wanted to do something now, you could conceivably drop them in, land them, and have them hold on while you tried to mobilize more troops.
Just to quickly follow up, the other question then is, like, would this actually reopen the strait? Because the Iranians don't have to be on the coast to fire drones at slow-moving oil tankers sailing through the Strait of Hormuz. Like, it's not even necessarily going to achieve the aim that you're trying to achieve, right?
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't achieve the aim. Drones, missiles from other parts of the country, you could launch USVs, boat drones from somewhere else and sail them up. So if it worked, it would eliminate one specific aspect of the threat to the Strait of Hormuz, but not two to three more. Also, right, you don't have to drop mines right in the Strait of Hormuz. If you really just want to disrupt shipping, they can drop untethered mines somewhere else and see where the current takes them.
So I think let's conclude on my question, unless Derek has something else, which is that I think, Harrison, you don't talk about this, but I think we do have to address it. Nukes.
Yeah.
With any other president, I would say extraordinarily unlikely, only if U.S. security is threatened. I could see a world in which Trump is backed into a corner and drops a quote unquote tactical nuke, which is just a nuclear weapon. Yeah. It's not a phrase that I like because it's just a lower yield nuclear weapon. Any thoughts about that previously unthinkable scenario, but is definitely thinkable now?
Yeah, I would think the much more likely version of that is that he tacitly approves Israel dropping a nuclear weapon. I think they would go for that first. I think even we'll see what lines like the Graham Rubio crowd is willing to cross. We could see that even them understanding that this is not going to be a popular idea. But if Netanyahu looks like he's running out of options to keep Trump in the war and that his window is closing, easy to see him saying, "Mr. President, we can solve this with a nuclear weapon. I don't really need you to help us. I just need you to not stop us." And that's been a very effective technique for getting Trump into wars before. And like that's what I'm most scared of, because what's the counterfactual, right? What's the scenario where Trump personally tells Netanyahu, "Do not do this thing or I will impose consequences." Maybe saw it a little bit with the initial like Gaza so-called ceasefire, but like we can't be confident that would happen.
I don't know if either of you guys saw this on X, the Everything site, yesterday, but so there was a Substack that posted like this obviously satirical piece kind of proposing that the U.S. Set off, I think they said, a dozen or so nuclear bombs to cut a channel across the UAE to avoid the Strait of Hormuz. And Newt Gingrich like reposted it apparently seriously. Like, here's an idea to get past the Strait of Hormuz. It was so amazing. Like, the brains on these people are really, they should be studied for medical science. But Harrison, I want to give you the last word here. You're with Win Without War. People are watching this horror show unfold. Yeah. They want to know what they can do to express their dissent to try and get a real peace movement going. Talk about some of the things you guys are doing and how people can get involved.
Absolutely. I'll say for like what normal folks can do, believe it or not, Congress actually does still matter. And even when I get depressed and feel like that's not the case, the amount of energy the Trump administration puts into whipping votes its way shows that it absolutely does care, even about the symbolic result of Congress voting against its wars or other policies. And so two things you can do. We had a war powers resolution 2 weeks ago that almost every Republican voted against, and a couple Democrats flipped on to. There's going to be more coming up. Also, probably within the next month, the administration is expected to introduce a supplemental funding bill to ask for possibly $50 billion more to quote unquote fund this war. It does not really do that. It's asking for future weaponry, which will come in 2 years and allow the U.S. and Israel to do even more wars. So it doesn't help anybody today. But if Congress votes for it, it's basically the closest we're going to have to Congress officially authorizing the war. So if you go to Win Without War's website and scroll a little bit, you'll see actions, petitions, and eventually call, devices that you can use to tell your member of Congress you really do not want them to vote for funding for this war or for further de facto authorizations. I think right now, with the Trump administration clearly still very concerned about keeping a patent of legitimacy around this war, those votes actually do matter quite a bit.
We'll have links for people to participate in those efforts in the show notes. And we'll also have a link to your Zatteo piece. But Harrison, really, thank you so much for coming on the program. This has been, a valuable conversation, and we would love to have you back anytime.
Thanks so much. I hope there's no occasion to invite me back, but otherwise I'm happy to be back here.
There's always going to be an occasion, I think. Yeah, something tells me. But thank you, Harrison.
Thanks so much.
This episode sponsored by Maximus Tribe. You train, you track, you eat right. But if you're over 40, you've felt it. The results don't match the effort anymore. That's not willpower, it's biology. Hormones drop, metabolism slows, your body stops responding the way it used to. Maximus is the online clinic that reverses your decline with prescription performance medicines, GLP-1s, testosterone, and peptides that reduce belly fat, restore energy, and boost recovery. Over 50,000 high performers have already broken through their plateaus. If you're ready to turn your hard work into measurable results, go to MaximusTribe.com. That's MaximusTribe.com.
It seems like just yesterday when I captured my son's first steps or when we recorded his soccer games on VHS tapes. Those moments are gone. But the old home movies and pictures don't need to be. That's why my son created Legacy Box.
That's right, Mom. Over a million families have used Legacy Box to digitally preserve their old home movies and photos.
Simply fill Legacy Box with your old camcorder tapes, film, and photos. They will professionally digitize and send them back on DVDs, thumb drive, or the cloud.
With Mother's Day around the corner, it's the perfect time to get your Legacy Box and save your family's history. After all, few things are as important as protecting your precious memories. Give your mom a Mother's Day present she'll never forget. Take advantage of our Mother's Day sale, which starts now. It's our best deal of the year. Save up to 60% off. Visit LegacyBox.com/keepsake, and for a limited time, get an incredible 60% off your order. That's LegacyBox.com/keepsake for 60% off. LegacyBox.com/keepsake.